and welcome to a subscriber exclusive edition of the Eye on the Tigers podcast. My name is Eli Hoff, and I'm your Mizzou beat writer here at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and STLtoday.com. If you're listening, I'm going to assume you found our new home for the podcast, which is STLtoday.com/podcast, or wherever else you manage to find this, you are in the right spot. Since we're putting these episodes behind the paywall now, I do want to make sure that this is a medium that provides value to you. You're one of our valued subscribers. So as such, these episodes are going to be a little bit more me pulling back the curtain at times, kind of emptying the notebook of what I'm seeing and hearing, but you know, what maybe isn't worth a whole story or tucking into a story. So there will be some segments going forward here that'll be more me kind of sharing information than just my thoughts or analysis. It'll be a mixture of both going forward. My hope is that comes together or comes off as something worth paying us your hard-earned money for every single month. That's a standard that I aspire to meet with this podcast and with the writing. With that in mind, today's show, we're going to preview Mizzou men's basketball and the SEC tournament that begins Thursday. What's at stake? What to expect of the Tigers? We'll go through three good things that could happen, three bad things that could happen down in Nashville, Tennessee. And then you're going to get a whole bunch of notes from what I've seen and heard and I'm thinking about during spring football practice. We've been out there a few times now. I think I've got enough of a grasp to share some things with you. Might be a little niche for the casual fan, but I don't think you guys are the casual fans here, so we'll fill that. And then we'll close this out with a quick look at the Mizzou women's basketball coaching search and the bigger picture future of that program. Since the last time we talked, Mizzou hoops played one game and lost that one, ending the regular season on a decidedly tenor note, which is to say a low note. Mizzou loses to Kentucky 91-83 at home to close the regular season. Mizzou finishes 21-10 overall, 10-8 in SEC play. We could get into that Kentucky loss and you know, do 20 minutes on it, but I'm just not sure how much it matters at this point in the season. Mizzou's defense seemed better than it was. I know you say, you know, they gave up 91 points. Kentucky's that good. In eye test-wise, especially in the first half, the defense was better. It wasn't great, but it was certainly more competitive. It was a game that you know, if Kentucky scores 91 points, that's a game that, when you've got the best offense in the nation over the last five games, you expect to compete. And I would argue the offense was more of a letdown for Mizzou than the defense. That's about the extent of what I think we take away at this point, because we're getting into, well, now especially we're getting into this part of the season, but even then on Saturday, where either you win or you don't. That becomes the only thing that matters, and really the only stat that matters. There's only one, I guess. There's two if you want to nitpick. Points. You could say points scored, points allowed, right? That's all that matters now. There are other stats that dictate results, that dictate what goes into winning or losing, but it really boils down to whether Mizzou, in any given game, wins and keeps playing or loses and calls it a season, right? There are two guaranteed games left, one in the SEC tournament, one in the NCAA tournament. That could be it, right? There could only be two games left for this team. Or there could be, you know, frankly, even if things go well, there's probably only four or five, right? When you start looking at this, but that's what it comes down to at this point. If your confidence in Mizzou's ability to keep playing or extend this season has eroded, I think that's valid. So as a way of previewing the SEC tournament, we're going to walk through the three best things that could happen to Missouri over in Nashville and the three worst. Knowing that the reality is, you know, there could be a mixture of good and bad things that happen, just like there are a mixture of good and bad things going on with this team. I'll leave it up to you as kind of what you think, what combination you think is the most plausible for that. And that's how we'll set this up. So real quick to set the stage for Mizzou in the SEC tournament. Mizzou is the number 7 seed in the SEC bracket, having finished 10-8, as we mentioned, and just with record alone, that ties for 6th in the SEC. but then you have tiebreakers come into play. So this is where tiebreakers actually played a very big role in establishing the bracket here. Three teams finished at 10-8. That was Missouri, Kentucky, and Ole Miss. Kentucky beat both of those teams, so they got the sixth seed. They won that kind of group of three tiebreaker. Mizzou lost to Kentucky, obviously, but did beat Ole Miss. So Mizzou gets the seven. Ole Miss was 0-2 against its fellow 10-8 clubs. So the Rebels get number eight. So Mizzou is the seven seed there. That means that Mizzou will face, it's a single bye, so to speak. Mizzou enters in the second round. Tigers will get the winner of a Wednesday game between 15 seed Louisiana State and 10 seed Mississippi State. Those two teams will play each other at 6 p.m. Wednesday. Winner then gets Missouri at 6 p.m. Thursday. If Missouri wins, it'll get one of the double bye teams. It'll get two seed Florida at 6 p.m. Friday. So LSU or Mississippi State to come on Thursday. If Mizzou wins, it's Florida on deck. Past that point, it gets into to bracket things, and you probably already do that. So let's get into these good and bad things, best and worst case scenarios. Good thing number one that could happen to Missouri is about as basic as it gets, and that's just Mizzou wins a game. By the time Thursday comes around, it'll have been 18 days since Mizzou did that, win a game. It's a three-game losing streak for Mizzou to end the regular season. Again, 18 days is not catastrophic. This is a program that went, I had the stat in the story, but probably 330 days between SEC wins, right? In terms of, actually, no, more than that, because it was 2 years. Whatever, they went almost 2 years between SEC play wins. So 18 days is not all that much. But by all accounts, this is a team that sure could use a win right now, if for nothing else than the mental standpoint, the confidence, all of that. Obviously, a win keeps Mizzou alive in the SEC tournament, keeps hopes of that going. But frankly, when you're not looking at Mizzou as a contender for the SEC title, right? That's number one Auburn. They lost a little bit recently, but that was after they locked up the number one seed. It does feel like it might be the Tigers, the Auburn Tigers, tournament to lose. But then Alabama and Florida are probably the 2 and 3 seed, certainly in the mix as contenders there. If you're Mizzou and you win a game here, I think that's some progress because it can prove to these players that they're capable of doing that. Good thing number two, though, is that Mizzou could make a run here, and there's an argument for this. So as far as the teams in that first game, LSU and Mississippi points at home back in January. That was the SEC home opener back before we really thought much of this team. That was the one where we're after. I was writing, this is their first SEC win in however many days that was, almost 2 years. And then Mizzou goes on the road at Mississippi State. Kind of, I guess, in retrospect, you could argue that was around when Mizzou was peaking. But goes and beats the Bulldogs down in Starkville by 27 points. So the template is there for Mizzou to beat these teams because it has beat them handily in the past. Then you win that game, you get Florida. Mizzou, of course, beat the Gators on the road in Gainesville. This is a neutral site. Maybe something's possible there. And then this is where you look more broadly at Mizzou's half of the bracket. So if they beat Florida, they would face the winner of a group that starts with Oklahoma and Georgia. Then the winner of that plays Kentucky. Winner of that plays Alabama. Mizzou against its collective half of the bracket did a lot of winning. Six wins, two losses is what I have written down. They've beat every team on their side of the bracket except for Kentucky. And again, that's a team that you would expect Mizzou could at least be competitive against Kentucky with kind of a ceiling level outcome. And that's lucky because the teams on the other side of the bracket, Mizzou is 2-6 against them. The other side of the bracket is loaded with teams that have beat Mizzou. Arkansas beat Mizzou. Ole Miss beat, or sorry, Ole Miss did not beat Mizzou. Auburn beat Mizzou. Texas did. Vanderbilt did. Texas A&M and Tennessee did. The only teams on the other side of the bracket that didn't are Ole Miss and South Carolina. The only teams on Mizzou's half that have beat it are Oklahoma. Is Oklahoma. This shapes up pretty favorably. Good thing number three, Mizzou could just flat out get healthy and rested. The injury report has been clear for the last two, maybe three games. Nobody listed on there. And after the Kentucky game, Dennis Gates was asked pretty directly and very clearly denied that there was any fatigue, mental or emotional or physical, in his program. But when you look at the energy, the intensity, sometimes even the effort seems to have been slipping a little bit lately. I think it's fair to wonder if there is just some degree of fatigue, and not necessarily any more than you would expect. This team has played 31 games. 18 of those were in the SEC. We keep talking about it as the best basketball conference in the country, potentially ever, in terms of not just space, but in time, right? The physicality that comes with that, it would be entirely understandable and acceptable if a team is a little worn down this time of year. Now, what you say is, every other team going to Nashville has just played 18 SEC games. They're all going to be tired and worn down too, and that's absolutely true. But this is one of those things, and Dennis Gates has sort of talked about this after the game against Kentucky, and again earlier today, recording on Tuesday, when he talked with reporters that he hopes the SEC hasn't, I forget the word he used, might have been battered, but that these teams haven't kind of run each other into the ground, and that that's going to lead to kind of a poor showing for the SEC in the NCAA tournament. You sure don't hope that happens, that you're the best conference in the country. Say you get 12 or 13 teams, then I actually don't know what the current thinking on how many SEC teams is, but certainly double digit teams in, and then only two of them are in the second weekend or something like that, right? That would, I don't want to say be counterproductive, but be a letdown. Anyway, fatigue, something I think is valid to wonder about at this point. Would it be the worst thing in the world? And we'll talk about some bad things in a second, but would it be the worst thing in the world if Mizzou goes to Nashville, gets that win, gets some confidence against Mississippi State or LSU, but probably Mississippi State, and then goes and loses to Florida, puts up a fight, but loses to Florida. That game will be on Friday. Then there's at least 6 days, if not a week, between that game and the start of the NCAA tournament, because the first round of March Madness takes place next week on Thursday and Friday. There will be some degree of travel involved for that. It could be as close as Wichita, could be as far away as Seattle or Providence, in which case, that is pretty significant travel, even if the team is able to, fly directly and privately. Getting 6 or 7 days between games this time of year could be nice, right? And part of what is interesting to me about the SEC tournament, and this is every conference tournament, it's not an exception, but whoever plays in the championship game is going to have played at least 3 games in 3 days. That's playing in the championship game. And that's if you're an Auburn, Alabama, Florida, Tennessee, one of those double bye teams. The championship game would be your third game in 3 days. If you're in the next tier, which is the A&M, Ole Miss, Mizzou, Kentucky tier, that's 4 games in 4 days. If somehow you make a run all the way, it's 5 games in 5 days. And this is, again, like we just said, five physical, intense, emotionally draining games. That's difficult to come out of doing fine. So if that for Mizzou is 2 games in 2 days, one of them is a win. Getting that week to heal up, focus up, recover a little bit, and reset going into March Madness, I don't think it's the worst thing. I'm sure people would be disappointed with losing to Florida, but again, I think there's a bright side here, and so good thing number three could just be getting healthy and rested. Let's talk about the bad things that could happen, because that can happen this time of year when a loss dooms you. A bad thing, number one, that would probably, be the second worst thing that could happen, would be Mizzou doesn't get a win and loses to Mississippi State. This is something that, while Mizzou will be favored against the Bulldogs, you really can't count them out. Yes, it was a 27-point win on the road. That's great and impressive and a stamp on Mizzou's resume. But Josh Hubbard down at Mississippi State is one of my favorite players to watch in the SEC. And I think probably if you're an SEC fan, one of your least favorite players to go up against. He has that ability to create off the dribble. He can shoot, he can get inside. All those things that just become a headache, frankly. So he's fully capable of winning a game there. They're a pretty good team down low as well. That would, I think, probably lock Mizzou into a 7 seed in the NCAA tournament. This is what has been striking with this losing streak. They've gone from, after that win over South Carolina, Mizzou was on the 4-5 seed line, probably mostly a 4 seed, and seemed like they had the potential, if they could win out and get a couple games in Nashville, potentially be maybe a 3 seed, right? Then Mizzou loses to Vanderbilt. That drops to okay, this is more like a five, right? They lose to Kentucky now, and even at that point it was looking, sorry, go to Oklahoma, lose there. Then it becomes more of all right, five or six line, and then lose to Kentucky. Now it's a six or seven line for this team, which is a pretty marked difference, I would think, just in terms of who you get in the tournament. If we look at the current bracketology, I'm looking at Bracket Matrix, which is a site I've really come to like because it collects everybody's brackets and kind of ranks them based on how accurate they are and makes a consensus, all that stuff. Bracket Matrix is a fun tool. Mizzou is the top seven seed right now. Now they've got an average seed of 6.35, so they're slightly behind Illinois, who has a 6.3. Right, that's the margins here, and it's all just guesses. But you do see that would put Missouri against a Michigan State or a St. John's, because you'd assume the selection committee would try to avoid in the second round, I should say. So, seven plays a 10 seed, and 10 seeds are the non-SEC 10 seeds are a Utah State throwback to a couple years ago, funnily enough, and a Baylor, right? You get that kind of mix. But Vanderbilt and Arkansas are also 10 seeds, so that gives you a frame of mind there. If you win that game, you're probably, well, maybe you get a 15 seed and you get another Princeton. Sorry to bring up the memories there. But, more likely you're getting a two seed where, Alabama and Tennessee looking like two seeds right now. Michigan State and St. John's are the two seeds who would probably be eligible to be matched up with Missouri there. That probably means you're playing in for Michigan State. I would assume probably Cleveland is where you're going there. If you're matched up with St. John's, you're probably going to Providence. But either way, that becomes a whole lot tougher to see a path out of the first weekend. If you're a six seed, you get an 11 seed to start, which can be risky. Like Drake looking like an 11 seed, San Diego State, they're always dangerous as an 11 seed. But then if you get out of that, then you're facing a team that's more like an Iowa State or a Texas Tech in that second round. That just it feels a little more winnable in my eyes than getting a team like St. John's or Michigan State right now. But we'll see how that shakes out. Bad scenario would be not winning, because that would seemingly lock Mizzou in at that seven seed. A win could keep Mizzou alive in the six seed discussion. Bad thing number two would be Mizzou not getting a win and losing it to LSU if LSU somehow beats Mississippi State. That would at this point be a bad loss. I don't know LSU's net if that would count as say a quad two game. It's a neutral site, so I would imagine no. But that's just not a game that you should be losing this time of year at that point. I don't want to say all bets would be off, but certainly, there would be even more questions and concerns than you have now. Bad thing number three would be, regardless of what happens out there, Mizzou emerges more tired than it is now, right? Whether or not there's fatigue right now, you don't want to emerge more fatigued than you are at this point in time. Frankly, unless you win the SEC tournament, you don't really remember much about it. If you think about the 22-23 season, Dennis Gates first in Columbia, what you remember is not the SEC tournament. There was a nice little run there, and that Mizzou won a game, but it's the NCAA tournament that you remember the opponents. You remember it was, the game against Princeton. You remember it was the game against Utah State. Those are the things you remember. Well, I won't mention a school from a past NCAA tournament run, but that's what's more memorable than anything in the SEC tournament. So we'll see what happens. What combination of good and bad things do emerge again? I think it kind of tends to be a combination of them. It's not mutually exclusive, but plenty on the line. The stakes are very high for Missouri. Now, on to some football notes. Spring football practice well underway. I actually don't know how many practices Mizzou has down at this point, but getting to the halfway point of spring ball, more or less. Been out to a few practices to see, it's individual drills, right? There's not scheme stuff happening, but see a little bit there. Talk to some of the coaches. I'm going to give you sort of a rundown, position by position. Not every position, because there's some that haven't been that notable, but just go position by position with what I'm seeing and hearing, to keep you guys updated again on what I'm thinking about, in addition to what I've written about in the stories there. This is one of those things where I don't overcover spring ball. The most interesting thing happening right now in Mizzou athletics is, of course, this basketball team. So that's going to be priority number one. And then football, we'll just get bits and pieces. But want to keep you guys fully up to date on what I'm seeing and hearing here. At quarterback, Bo Prabila, the new guy, Penn State transfer, he has earned his number. As a reminder, when any new player comes into this program, whether a transfer portal guy or a freshman, they practice in a blank jersey at first. Numbers are something that Eli Drinkwitz believes has to be earned. I'm not going to say it's common at other programs, but I do think this is something that happens at other football programs. So Bo Prabila out there with a blank jersey like the rest of the newcomers, he has since earned it. That's something that's determined by coaches, and I think players too actually have a say in voting when a guy has put in a particularly good performance, get to earn his number. He's wearing number 9. It's what he wore at Penn State, or I think, unless he wore number 6, but I think he wore number 9. I'm doubting that, and I should have looked it up before I recorded, but he'll wear number 9 for Mizzou. We did see the quarterbacks throw a little bit on Tuesday. Nothing crazy, right? Not against the defense, not with anybody in their face or anything like that, but saw some throwing there. Bo Prabila looked pretty smooth throwing on the run, which is good. But so did the other quarterbacks. Again, this is just, throwing to a running back and a tight end 10 yards down the field. It's nothing crazy there. My one takeaway on that, though, Matt Zollers, the true freshman, looks like he belongs in the throwing drill, which is, I do think, again, I'm not going to use the throwing drill to parse out Prabila and Pine and Horn. We've talked about where the quarterback competition stands at this point and that it's going to last into fall camp. But Zollers, like, if I didn't know who anybody was and you said, look at these throws and pick out the freshman, I'd have a hard time doing it. And I don't want this to come off as a knock on the guy I'm about to mention, but like, couldn't say that about Aiden Glover, who was last year's true freshman quarterback. You could tell. Sollers, you can't tell. He put some good zip on the balls, got good form, good poise. So again, very tentative takeaway there. I don't view Sollers as a real contender in the quarterback competition. It's been a three-horse race from the start, but good to see that he's coming in and seems to have that polish. I think it reinforces the fact that he's a highly touted prospect and has a pretty high ceiling. At running back, I am snapping up Ahmad Hardy stock like a turtle. His build, he's got legs to power through anybody, and by that I mean arm tackles. Like, if you arm tackle Ahmad Hardy, you're not bringing him down. He already seems to be one of the most liked guys in the locker room. This is something that I'll have a feature story on at some point. I'm sure we're figuring out the right way to do it, but he likes riding horses. If you follow him on Twitter at all, you'll see him posting about his horses. And he's got at least a horse in Columbia. I want to figure out the logistics of this, but he brought Kevin Coleman, wide receiver, out and taught him to ride a horse. It sounds like some other players have been out to ride horses with him. Just a real personality, super funny guy. One of the most liked guys on this team, and he's only been in Columbia for a couple of months. Only been practicing, spring practice wise, for a couple of weeks. Marquise Davis, who's a freshman, a true freshman, early enrollee. I think he could have a role. He's got the build down too. He and Hardy are both similarly of that kind of stocky physical role. And I think that suits where this team wants to go. Obviously, they need to be able to run the outside zone and the inside zone. That's going to be a foundation of any Eli Drinkwitz team. But I think there might be a little more, what's the word? Punch, power to the offense. That's just my sense, kind of looking at these players and the way they want to run their style. So Marquise Davis certainly has the physical build, I think, to come in as a freshman and be able to make some noise. And frankly, when I'm watching practice and watching running back reps, I've noticed those two, Davis and Hardy, a lot more than the returners, who are Jamal Roberts and Tavoris Jones. Now, maybe that's just my eye gravitating towards the newcomers and trying to see new guys and figure out, who's who without some of these jersey numbers and stuff, though. Hardy and Davis have both earned their jersey numbers. Davis wearing 7, which has been worn by a pretty good running back in recent memory. Ahmad Hardy wearing 29, which is a fun kind of, I guess, I don't know if it's really old school, but it's a more traditional running back number than you see from some of these single digits. So we'll see. Like, Jamal Roberts, there's room for him to take a leap there and certainly have a role as a returner. Did really well in pass protection last year, but Ahmad Hardy, I think he, like I said, I think now's a good time to be buying up stock for him. at the wide receiver position, Marquise Johnson talked to him today. A lot of times when we're talking to these players out at spring practice, we'll ask sort of an open-ended, what are your points of emphasis type of question, just to kind of ascertain what they are working on during spring practice. You get answers of technique, things like Blake Craig. Well, I'm going to jump out of position order here. Blake Craig, the kicker, working on right hash from 40 to 49 yards. That's his priority, is to figure out kicking from there, because that was such a weak spot last year, and nobody's dancing around that fact. It was very obvious if you saw it, and it's even more obvious if you look at the stats. But Marquise Johnson said it's just been maturity for him this offseason, which is interesting. That's not something we hear very often from these guys, and certainly you might hear that from a coach, but from a player to say that's what he's been working on, that he in other words basically said that he's working on being a different kind of man. And I give him credit for saying that. That's not an easy thing to come out and say publicly, that you feel like you're being tasked with growing up for your job or for your team. But it's also sort of the reality of this wide receiver room, that last year this was touted as potentially the best group of wideouts in the country. You had Luther Burden, who, first round talent, Luther Burden, and Theo Weiss, one of the most veteran guys out there, and Bukie Cooper. And then, of course, you have Joshua Manning and Marquise Johnson as part of that. But this turnover in the room, the most veteran guy is Kevin Coleman, who's come in, but he's brand new and on his fourth school in 4 years. He's not someone who you can come in and expect to have the same leadership style as someone who's in their third year with this program. So that's where I think a lot more becomes necessary for a guy like Marquise Johnson. He can't just be the speedster who's kind of the younger sibling to anyone anymore. He needs to do that. So, certainly something intangible with him. Though it does seem, talking to him without pads on, I feel like he might have bulked up a little bit. We'll see. Certainly it's only been like 2.5 months since the end of the season, so hard to put on too much mass at that point. But it will be interesting to see come fall camp, when these guys get weighed again and the weights update. Maybe he's got an extra 5 or 10 pounds of muscle on him there. Don't think that would detract from his speed too much, frankly. And with him as well, he mentioned that with this spring camp, he's feeling healthy, which is good. Still had tape on that ankle, but that is good for him. Also at wideout, Sean Terry, who is a true freshman early enrollee, he's in the mix to be a potential punt returner. Again, I don't know how likely it is. I think that's probably Kevin Coleman's role, and then Daniel Blood, who was the number two at it last year and got plenty of touches back there when Luther Burden wasn't returning punts. Daniel Blood is back, so I would expect those two to be number one and two. But Sean Terry is in the mix at that. Again, we'll see what that looks like. Maybe that's something that is more of a next year, the year after thing. But keep that on your radar. On the offensive line, this is something really, really interesting to keep track of. But Whit Hafer, who was a tight end last year, moved from tight end to offensive line, which like is not the most outlandish position change in the world. Like it'd be a bigger deal if somebody's going like corner to offensive line, right? But it seems like that's going well. Now I don't know. It's hard to know the kind of context of what going well means, right? I don't think the expectation is that he's going to go from fourth string tight end or fifth string tight end, whatever he actually wound up being last year, to starting right tackle or something like that. It's certainly a project, but it seems like that's going well. Logan Reichert, who's someone who I'd written in going into the spring, could really benefit here, step into a bigger role, all that with a guard spot up for grabs, and he's a highly touted recruit. Now it's kind of the time. We've talked about Logan Reichert here before and certainly written about him. I have not seen him practicing yet. He's someone who is pretty recognizable out there. Wears 66, big guy. He was in a boot at the Music City Bowl. He wasn't part of the bowl practices there. I don't know exactly what the issue is, but I'm told by folks who know that it is still that issue. So foot or ankle, lower leg issue with Logan Reichert, keeping him out of spring practice. The recovery is going as expected. It just is the sort of thing that, again, it's only 2 months since they were practicing on the Vandy campus ahead of the Music City Bowl. So something a little more long term. It's something like Brett Norfleet. We'll jump back to tight end. He's been in a green non-contact jersey, but the word certainly is that Like if there was a game this weekend, he'd be playing in it. There's no reason to rush these guys back for spring ball. So I would assume Rijkaard is in a similar category there, where if they were needing him, maybe this goes a little bit different, but better to preserve his health for the fall. Henry Finucane, a freshman early enrollee, we're going to keep shouting them out today. It seems like he's been in the mix with some reps here. It's hard to figure out depth chart stuff at this point. There's been some red herrings thrown out there by coaches reps wise. We're just not seeing a whole lot there, but he's been in the mix. He's one of these guys who has the build. Maybe it's out of need, again, given some injuries on the offensive line that have affected the availability of players here. But I'm wondering if he's someone who could be in the mix in fall camp, be in the two deep again. Potential, I think, is there. Still thinking Mizzou might look for a tackle via the transfer portal. On the defensive line, speaking of freshmen with the build to show it, Javion Hilson was a late addition to the recruiting class on signing day. Comes in very highly touted as one of the best defensive ends in the country. Has the frame to contribute. I haven't, the edge rushers haven't been doing live reps again. There's no really going against each other. Offensive line, defensive line, or wideouts versus corners, none of this. Not that we'd really see it anyway. But he doesn't look like a freshman in terms of build. Eddie Kelly Jr., returner from last year, changed his jersey number. He was 97 last year. He is zero this year. And let me tell you, there is something kind of terrifying about seeing a big guy wearing number zero coming around the edge towards you. He is not someone I would want to be tackled by. Talked to Zion Young, defensive end, last week about this group, and there's a lot of newcomers here, right? Damon Wilson, the second coming from Georgia, Javion Hilson, Nate Johnson, edge rusher from App State, Lightning Kitchen coming over from D2 from Northwest Missouri State, Darius Smith coming back. We were asking him about all these guys, and every single time he just say like, "Oh, he's a freak. He's a freak." And we were laughing about it, but you see the athleticism in this defensive end room, and not just the athleticism, but the pairing of size and power and athleticism. I fully believe him that there are a lot of athletic freaks in that group. In all honesty, looking at this entire roster and the construction of it, if I'm a Mizzou fan, the defensive end group might be the group I'm the most excited about. Simply because there really are, when you look at Smith and Wilson and Zion Young and Eddie Kelly and even Ja'Kai Lang, who's in the mix, and maybe Hilson turns into something, and what Nate Johnson are, there are really five or six guys who I think you can make the case should be contributing to the rotation next year. And maybe it's a six-man rotation at defensive end. Maybe it's just some more depth if an injury comes up. Really exciting group of defensive ends to look at here. The second to that in terms of positional quality would be linebacker. There's a pretty steep competition going on here. I don't know how it shakes out at this point in time, but I can say it looks like Khalil Jacobs is good to go. He is also switched numbers. I think he's wearing number five now. That's one that we don't have a confirmed list of who wears what, so we've got to sleuth this out a little bit. I think he's wearing five now. Not that that especially matters to you all anyway, but good to go after his season-ending injury. He's someone who followed Corey Batun, his defensive coordinator, over from South Alabama, played a really big role in that third down package. He's one of the maybe more key returners, so to speak, just because he plays a really big role for this team. On the secondary, I haven't seen all that much, and to be honest, this comes back to the lack of numbers issue. Without numbers in a roster, and frankly, a lot of guys who came in here, I don't even want to try to name them because I will forget somebody. Because every day at practice, well, some of the writers, when we're watching, we're trying to figure out, okay, is that Mark Manfred? Is that Mose Phillips? Is that Stephen Hall? And then we'll all of a sudden forget somebody who is a safety or a corner. So don't really have the numbers to sort all of that out. It's just hard to distinguish when they're in pads and not wearing numbers. But Santana Banner is easy to identify because he stands out, listed at 6'3", 207. He is a big guy playing safety. Maybe that leads him to play that star role that Dalen Carnell plays. It's the sort of hybrid safety. I haven't seen him repping there. Haven't been told he's repping there. But regardless of where he lines up, big guy coming down to make some plays He's making the jump from he's a transfer from Northern Illinois, beat Notre Dame last year. As far as the specialists go, this is where we've actually today talking to Eric Link, the special teams coordinator. We got the most concrete indicator yet of what Mizzou's going to be doing in the spring transfer portal. He said that expect a punter and a long snapper to come in from the portal, unless something happens here. I've got a story that'll be out around the same time as this podcast, but probably coming out Wednesday morning at stltoday.com about the special teams room right now. It is I'm gonna say it's a shell of what it was, not necessarily in terms of quality, but in terms of quantity. Drastically scale down the number of specialists on the roster. This is part of the future of college sports. As part of the house settlement, which is bringing about revenue sharing, is also bringing about roster limits in sports. So football is a really interesting example of this. You go from in years past, like last year, teams could have 85 players on scholarship and 120 players on the roster. So that gives you 85 scholarship and 35 walk-ons. And so you'd see a ton of these walk-ons, especially at specialist stuff, right? Like you're not gonna, Mizzou had four kickers on the roster last year. They were not all on scholarship, right? They're not putting four kickers in the 85. Now, or I should say, so once the house settlement is approved, which is expected to come in about a month here, the roster limit will be 105 scholarship players, and that's it. So the positive spin you'll hear from folks arguing this in court is, well, it's more scholarship spots. The negative spin in what has been the subject of court objections to this settlement has been, but it's fewer overall spots, right? So it's 25 more scholarship, but 15 fewer spots overall. That impacts the specialists. You saw a lot of these guys who were walk-on level specialists transfer out over the offseason. And this has an impact. This is college sports in 2025 and beyond. So Mizzou slimmed down maybe a little bit more than it needed to here. So I'm going to add a couple players in via the portal, or at least try to. But talking to Eric Link, the coordinator, it's going to be interesting how this shakes out. So you've got Blake Craig back at kicker, Robert Meyer, who's a true freshman, who was supposed to be a preferred walk-on, but again, that designation going away. They're at kicker. You have Connor Wesselman, who was a transfer from Stanford. He was a backup there, which is, again, why an addition at this position I think will be valuable. You've got him at punter, but right now he's the only punter on the roster. So you also have Blake Craig and Robert Meyer punting during practice. They're doing both. Blake Craig has talked to him today, and he's done both before. He can do it, and he's finding it sort of fun to do. But they're overlapping there. Only have one long slant, and it's one long snapper right now. And that's Brett LeBlanc. Last year, Mizzou had three on the roster and used two during games, down to one right now. So the backup long snapper, should they need one for any reason, would be Tommy Reese, who is a linebacker. So it was interesting today. Part of what I'd gone into today's practice wanting to write this story and talk to people about it. But I was watching the specialists while they're practicing, and sure enough, Brett LeBlanc is just by himself working as a long snapper. That's the landscape. That's the landscape. So I know, some folks will maybe dismiss that story because they don't want to read about the specialist, but I promise you it's interesting. And Eric Lincoln was pretty candid about what that means. If you are, this is not a position note anymore, but if you are a St. Louis City SC fan, we've of course got coverage for you. But if you are going to the game this Saturday and you think you see a Mizzou football coach or player in the stands or in the stadium, you're probably right that there'll be a little football and football overlap this weekend. I've been told the team's spring field trip, so to speak. I don't actually know if they call it that, but that's kind of what it is heading over to the St. Louis City game against the Seattle Sounders on Saturday. I don't know who the soccer fan on staff is. If you're someone who knows, I'd love to know who that is. But this might be a little awkward for Blake Craig because he has an NIL deal, or had an NIL deal, with Sporting Kansas City. Before we close out the show, quick women's basketball update here as the MU administration is looking for a new women's basketball coach following Robin Pinchon's departure. So Laird Veach, the athletics director, met with the media last Friday, and to share a little bit about the search, take some questions. And I guess I'll preface this by saying action, by which I mean the eventual hire and the amount of money given to that coach in terms of salary and to build a roster, right? That will speak louder than words. But the words right now, that Mizzou wants to invest in women's basketball and be competitive. And again, we've talked about this on the pod before, so many of you have probably listened. But it takes money to compete in a conference like the SEC that is extremely competitive in the sport. You see, what a South Carolina and Texas made it to the SEC championship game this year. You see what it takes to get there, and that's money and investment, because that shows a school cares about it. And Mizzou hasn't been at that level. Laird Veach was candid in saying that it's going to take money to get to that level, and it might not be overnight. Whoever this coach is going to come into a program that has won, I think, 5 SEC games in the last 2 years. There is certainly work to be done, perhaps some players to retain, but the transfer portal opens on March 24th or 25th, whatever that Tuesday is when the transfer portal opens. So ideally, they're looking to have a coach in place by then, but it's one of those things where you can't really force it. If the coach's team is still in the tournament, they're not going to leave that. If there's any goal of being competitive next year, certainly having the coach in place to make the most of that portal window would be ideal. But I think the expectation is a little bit more being competitive, 3 years down the road, in which case, how much does one portal window mean? I'm not sure. But this is the only portal window in basketball. There's not a spring and a fall like there is in football. So important there. Can also tell you that when Laird Veach is talking about this level of investment, he met with the UM System Board of Curators last week in a closed session. The women's basketball front and program and search and that as a concept, that was at least one of the talking points. And given what he said after that meeting, when meeting with us, I'm inclined to think he has the board's backing on this to put some money behind this. Again, we'll see, but the signs are pointing there. The STL Today hot board that we came out with a couple weeks ago had three coaches on it: Molly Miller down at Grand Canyon, Kelly Harper, who is currently a free agent but was at Tennessee, and Charmin Smith, who is from St. Louis, currently out at Cal. That was the STL Today hot board. Since then, reports have come out that all three are candidates. So backing that, some other names in the mix too, but those three were the three that seemed most intriguing to me at the time. We'll keep you updated there. Harper, again, is a free agent, so theoretically could be hired anytime. Miller with Grand Canyon, one of the what is it, the WAC, Western Athletic Conference. I don't actually know what the conference stands for there. They are in the NCAA tournament, the Lopes. So she's got to let that play out. Charmin Smith and Cal, I believe, are on track for tournament spot as well. So, it might be a matter of waiting until that first or second weekend is done before either of those could be hired. Some other names in the mix too. We'll keep you updated as the Mizzou women's basketball coaching search continues. That's our show for today. Hopefully some interesting nuggets in there for those of you who took the time to listen. Thank you. Thank you for doing so. And an even bigger thank you for being one of our subscribers. You make coverage like what you're going to see in this basketball postseason possible. I'll be in Nashville starting tomorrow. Head over to take in some games, and cover the Tigers as long as they're there. Wherever March Madness is, we will be there. All of that, it costs money to make happen. But you guys make that possible, so I do sincerely appreciate that. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this subscriber-exclusive episode of the Eye on the Tigers podcast. Have a great rest of your day.